environment and politics, and their actual risk of exposure to pollution linked to the county they lived in. If, in 2010, you lived in a county with a higher exposure to toxic pollution, we discovered, you are more likely to believe that Americans worry too much about the environment and to believe that the United States is doing more than enough about it. You are also more likely to describe yourself as a strong Republican. There it was again. The great paradox, only now it applied to my keyhole issue, environmental pollution across the entire nation. Far from being an oddball state, Louisiana told a nationwide story. See Appendix B. The least resistant personality. I thought back to the Areno home on Bayou Din. Why did PPG and other companies decide to build there and not somewhere else? Proximity to oil certainly came first, but were there other factors too? The poorer the state, research found, the less regulated it was likely to be. So were poor people in poor states less likely to worry about out-of-state profit leakage or state handouts to industry? Or were they understandably just hoping for a job and preparing to endure? Certainly, no Louisianan I talked to liked pollution. But what if some people are more prepared than others to put up with things they didn't like? After I'd returned home from my visit to Baton Rouge, I discovered an illuminating report on how industries deal with the fact that people don't want them to move in next door. It was written by J. Stephen Powell of the Los Angeles-based consulting firm Serrell Associates, Incorporated, and was entitled Political Difficulties Facing Waste-to-Energy Conversion Plant Siting. The 57-page report was proprietary and eventually leaked, by whom I couldn't find out. It was produced in a different time, 1984, and place, Los Angeles, but is as relevant today as it was then. The California Waste Management Board paid Serrell Associates $500,000 to define communities that would not resist locally undesirable land use, LULU. Undesirable is what the Arenos felt about Pittsburgh Plate Glass in Bayou Din. The plant that the Waste Management Board wanted to set up would be hard to live near. The facility being considered would smell and sometimes be noisy. Waste-to-energy facilities also pose a potential health risk in terms of air pollution, Powell wrote. Emissions from a plant may include varying amounts of nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, hydrocarbons, and particulate matter and other matter for which health standards have not yet been established. Company trucks could cause traffic congestion. The plant would reduce property values and provide relatively few jobs, he also pointed out. So, how can such a company get a community to accept it? The plant manager's best course of action, Powell concluded, would not be to try to change the minds of residents predisposed to resist. It would be to find a citizenry unlikely to resist. Based on interviews and questionnaires, Powell drew up a list of characteristics of the least resistant personality profile. Longtime residents of small towns in the South or Midwest, high school educated only, Catholic, uninvolved in social issues and without a culture of activism, involved in mining, farming, ranching, what Serrell called nature exploitative occupations, conservative, Republican, advocates of the free market. When the big oil companies first came to Louisiana in the 1940s, 40% of adults in Louisiana had no more than a fifth-grade education. and its citizens were the least likely in the nation to move out of state. From the 70s on, most people had become Republican advocates of the free market and minimal government. Most of the people I met fit some or all of the criteria. They were longtime residents, high school educated, half were, conservative, and Republican. That description fit the Arenos and largely fit Lee Sherman. Those who resisted the oil industry fit a very different profile. Young, college-educated, urban, liberal, strongly interested in social issues, and believers in good government. Was the least resistant personality one susceptible to what General Honoré had called the psychological program? The talk of jobs, jobs, jobs that had just enough to it? Or was that too easy an idea from my side of the empathy wall? I'd taken measure of the talk and silences of public life in the heartland of the right. I'd seen what my Tea Party friends were putting up with. But the empathy wall was higher than I'd imagined. I could see what they couldn't see, but not, as Yogi Berra might say, what I couldn't see. I still felt blind to what they saw and honored. I needed to do something else, to enter the social terrain that surrounded and influenced them. Included in that were industry, state government, the church, and the press. How did these basic institutions influence their feelings about life? I thought I would start with industry, which is what brought me across the I-10 bridge from Lake Charles to an open door at the office of Mayor Bob Hardy in Westlake City Hall. Part 2. The Social Terrain. 6. Industry, the buckle in America's energy belt. Seated in the Westlake mayor's office with Bob Hardy, I am watching a video of a groundbreaking ceremony honoring the expansion of Sasol, the South Africa-based petrochemical giant, 6 miles northeast of the Arenos home in Bayou Din. At 60, Hardy is a vital, athletic, balding man, boyish in manner, eyes fixed on the video with irrepressible delight. On screen, 200 dignitaries in suits and ties sit facing the microphone. On a 3,034-acre site, Sasol is investing $21 billion in an energy complex that will be the single largest foreign direct investment manufacturing project in U.S. history. It is part of an even larger planned multi-company investment totaling $84 billion spread over 66 industrial projects in southwest Louisiana over the next 5 years. A cutter on the bayou, the Wall Street Journal called it. It will call for losing 26 public roads, buying out 883 public property lots, and in their place will rise new cities of fertilizer plants, boron manufacturers, methanol terminals, polymer plants, ammonia factories, and paper finishing facilities. Mayor Hardy is the 7th speaker. "I didn't have a thing written down," he recalls, "but I thought I should look like I did." An instrumentation foreman at Phillips 66, before running for mayor of Westlake, Hardy hasn't given many public speeches, he says. "So I just got up there with my iPad. It had a picture of my wife, so I looked at her." He passes me his iPad to show me the image of his seated, dark-haired, smiling wife. His iPad facing him, part shield, part support, Bob tells the dignitaries that Westlake has been home to 4 generations of Hardys. A road there bears his family name. He, his father, his son, have worked in local plants, as he hopes his grandson will. "But things here will have to change," he adds. "My son and his wife have dreamed a long time about building their own home. At last, in 2015, they were in the middle of building it here in Westlake, near my wife and me. I was helping my son put in his plumbing. Then he told me Sasol needed his land. It wanted him to sell and move. I got up from my plumbing and said, "Son, I'll help you put in plumbing in your next house." The audience was rapt. Westlake is a sprawling gray expanse of smokestacks rising from immense steel-girded fortresses with a row of enormous, round, white, flat-topped storage tanks, which, illuminated at night, looks like a strangely beautiful great emerald city. But there is often a chemical odor. They say, "Ah, Westlake, y'all got that smell," Hardy continues in his speech. I say, "Man, that smells like rice and gravy." The audience laughs knowingly and applauds more loudly than for other speakers. I was meeting with Mayor Hardy to try to see the great paradox from his point of view. The people I was getting to know would have strongly resisted Dr. Templay's analysis that the oil industry suppressed other lines of work, drew a third of revenue out, left pollution, and did nothing to resolve the many problems saddling the state. I was trying to enter the state of mind in which criticisms of the over-reliance on oil or the harmful side effects of fracking would seem misdirected, in which other things loomed more important. Among my Tea Party friends, the mention of Sasol was often accompanied by the word billion, as in a $7 billion investment for the ethane cracker, a $14 billion investment for the gas-to-liquids plant. It conveyed the idea of power, importance, and prosperity. Did this enormous investment overturn Templay's dim picture of jobs in fossil fuels, I wondered, or illustrate it? Maybe the new fracking-spurred gold rush helped explain why people were dying to relieve themselves of the federal government. Who needed it, with such opportunity at hand? My visit to Hardy would be a first step in exploring the institutional context conducive to the worldview of Mike Schaff, Lee Sherman, and others of the right. Westlake and Lake Charles had recently become ground zero in a surprising new gold rush for natural gas. The gas could be sucked from the ground, piped to plants, processed into various chemical feedstocks, and piped out to still other plants, which manufactured such things as frisbees, plastic hairbrushes, garden hoses, steering wheels, computer cases, bubble yum, bed liners, medical gowns, jet fuel, wasp spray, grocery bags, and Hershey bars. After we talk, Mayor Hardy drives me around Westlake to give me a sense of what the Sasol expansion will mean. It's a 2-mile-square town, surrounded by land zoned heavy industrial, and indeed inhabited by industry. It has a weekly newspaper, 1 high school, 1 middle school, 2 elementary schools, 4 banks, and 18 churches. We pass a Family Dollar store, auto repair shops, a ribeye and burger bar, and the Isle of Capri Casino Hotel. Such signs of a town's life hardly seem heavy industrial, but that doesn't mean they won't be soon. Hardy can already envision which buildings will come down and which others will go up. "See that Assembly of God church? Sasol bought it for $2,500,000. We'll tear it down and build over it. They paid $4 million for First Baptist. It's as if money is no matter. They need to enlarge the road to haul in heavy equipment. See that?" Hardy is pointing out the window. "That's a Methodist church. The deacon overbid, wanted $1,300,000. Sasol backed away from the table. Now the state may declare eminent domain and give it to Sasol, which will tear it down. The congregation may not get a penny. A member of the Board of Trustees is waiting in my office now," Hardy said. "He wants me to push Sasol to pay them to move. We'll see." We pass a cemetery. On one side of a bisecting roadway, the lawn is freshly cut. Hardy has just mowed it himself. On the other side, payment came from a different source. The dead were black, and the lawn less recently cut. After he retired from Phillips 66, Bob kept a part-time job cutting public lawns. It had stuck with him when his sister said, "You're mayor now, Bob, but stay who you are." Cutting lawns has kept him a regular guy, connected to the place he deeply loves. His two daughters and son all lived within blocks of him in Westlake in large, shrub-lined suburban homes. His brother had lived nearby but had recently taken Sasol money and moved. Hardy had helped to build his parents' nearby home, too. In their 80s now, they were planning to remain, as Sasol moved in, zoning land heavy industrial around them. Hardy has embraced the changes and shares with me his vision of a new Westlake, one 25 to 30% larger in population.
"See that park? I'd like to double it. And that golf course? We could put in tasteful housing for executives and professionals coming in."
But some of his grand vision glosses over possible problems now troubling local residents. He slows down his SUV to point out the window to an acre of grass.
"See that? We could plant a screen of trees right there and put up a man camp behind it."
"A man camp?" I ask.
"We're expecting 5,000 temporary construction workers and 500 permanent technical workers. The construction workers will stay in man camps," he explains matter-of-factly.
According to the local American press, industry would have openings for new welders, scaffolding workers, pipe fitters, operators, iron workers, insulators, instrumentation techs, and electricians. R.B. Smith, vice president of workforce development at the Southwest Louisiana Economic Development Alliance, urged potential local workers to invest in yourselves and train in a trade. But others said that local applicants weren't coming forward because they'd learned that companies wouldn't hire them without experience. Apprenticeships, which the companies themselves weren't offering. Instead, the American press said, construction and workforce developers are targeting international locals in Ireland, which has an unemployment rate of 14.6%, and the Philippines, to fill service industry and construction jobs. So, behind a strip of trees is where the man camps housing foreign workers would stand. Residents don't want the man camps near them, Hardy says. What if the imported workers included rapists or burglars? They'd ask the mayor.
I don't want to tell them, but they're already living near a few registered sex offenders in nearby trailer parks.
They just don't know it. Hardy describes another dilemma more on his mind.
The previous mayor handed me a deficit budget. So, Westlake is broke. Meanwhile, Sasol hasn't given me a dime. We're right in the middle of their expansion, but mostly they don't actually need our land, except for some heavy haul throughways. But we could use some money, like to build the man camp here in Westlake, or executive housing on the golf course. I've been petting Sasol's dog. I'm waiting to see if they'll come through. If they don't, I have a trick in my bag.
Hardy stops his SUV, chuckling, and points to a nondescript strip of weeds.
See that 300-foot strip? That piece of land belongs to me. Sasol can't build over it or under it, and they need it. So that's the trick in my bag. I don't want to have to call my lawyer and pull it out, but I can. I'd like to use it to improve this town.
There is a history of discovery and invention behind the fracking boom. Rich alluvial soil has opened the way for the growth of cotton, rice, and sugarcane, like that Mike Schaff had shown me on the former Armalee's plantation. But in a sodden rice field in 1901, a farmer discovered oil. In the 1920s and 1930s,
technology was adapted to drilling along the marshy Louisiana coast, then in the 1940s, along the outer continental shelf. Along the way, an enormous warren of pipelines was laid below ground, above ground, and underwater. Then, from 2003 on, new technology enabled the horizontal fracturing of shale rock. Drill bits can now bore down 1,000 to 5,000 feet into the earth and turn sideways. Water, salt, and chemicals, the exact composition remains proprietary information, can be pressure pumped through the pipes to crack open shale rock, and other pumps suck out the natural gas that is released. Seen as an environmental curse to many, the fracking boom brought money and pride to Mayor Hardy and most others I talked to. Stuck in the South, the poorest region in the nation, Louisiana now seemed perched to become the proud center of an industrial renaissance, a shiny new buckle in the nation's energy belt. Louisiana wouldn't come last. It would come first. And that would bring a welcome end to the great paradox. On the brink of the boom. The fracking boom was big. People I talked to followed it proudly. Leading economists were forecasting for Louisiana one of the highest growth rates in the country, a five-year growth rate for 2014 to 2018 of 4.7%. New jobs would be highly paid. Salaries for permanent workers would hover around $80,000 plus benefits. As a carpenter in Louisiana, you can earn about $33,000. As a truck driver, $46,000. And as an elementary school teacher, $34,000. Maybe you needed training to get a job as a plant operator, but you didn't need a college degree. And it wasn't just jobs. Fracking could strengthen American foreign policy. Instead of importing oil from unstable or authoritarian countries like Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan, the United States could extract natural gas from its own soil. It could even export natural gas through a widened Panama Canal to energy-hungry Japan or to a Russia-dependent Ukraine. Indeed, the two biggest oil refineries in southwest Louisiana, Citgo and Phillips 66, which usually imported oil from Mexico and Venezuela, were reconfigured to export it. But in all the euphoria, missing was any public mention of the new sources of pollution that were to be added to the old. In my hour and a half with Mayor Hardy, that topic didn't arise. Hadn't Lake Charles been through an investment rush before, and hadn't it resulted in the pollution of Bayou Din? Similar hosannas had gone up in 1966 when Pittsburgh Plate Glass first moved upstream from Bayou Din. In 1966, the American press had written of how investments stagger the imagination. An editorial described how chemicals PPG produced would help rubber resist abrasion, add color to rubber, and make ink pigment that wouldn't show through the backside of a newspaper. The wonders of new investments, products, and jobs had all felt to the citizenry of the 1960s, including Harold and Annette Areno, as exciting as they did to Mayor Hardy now. The Sasol plant alone is expected to emit 85 times the state's threshold rate of benzene each year, Dennis Berman wrote in the Wall Street Journal. It will also produce massive streams of carbon dioxide and treated water. "I don't want to wear a gas mask to go to bed at night," one pipe fitter declared at one 4.5-hour public hearing regarding the Sasol expansion. Sasol also sought and received permission to use public water, 13 million gallons a day of relatively clean water from the Sabine River. This it would use, pollute, and dump back in the Calcasieu River. In addition, the state granted Sasol permission to emit an estimated 10 million tons of new greenhouse gases every year. no effort at carbon capture was proposed. And now that the door was open, more companies were submitting similar proposals, anticipating similar approval. "How about the issue of water use?" I asked Hardy. "The companies are in compliance," he answers. And indeed they were. The state had okayed it. Meanwhile, the city government of Lake Charles launched its own Ozone Advance program, which focused exclusively on what private citizens could do. They could drive shorter routes in their cars, or walk. They could quit idling their car engines. They could mow their lawns less often. The plan called for a school flag program. Green for good, yellow for moderate, red for high ozone, to let the community know that if you have somebody that has difficulty breathing, today's not a good day to be outside. As I was trying to climb this slippery empathy wall, a subversive thought occurred to me. Do we need all the new plastic the American Chemical Association is promising us? Weren't we entering into a strange cycle? Many people I was talking to carried around plastic water bottles, partly for convenience, partly out of distrust of local waters. And with cheap natural gas at hand, the American Chemical Association said it could triple the amount of feedstock needed to make plastic. But if we triple our plastics, more petrochemical companies will pollute more public waters, which will lead more people to pay for more plastic bottles filled with ever more scarce clean water. We'll throw away more plastic bottles, buy more, and further expand the market for plastic, the production of which pollutes water. But I was straying from my goal, getting into the spirit of things. Two roads to prosperity. Huey Long versus Bobby Jindal. The heady excitement of the fracking boom hides some deeply important and little discussed political choices, of course. In the last Louisiana oil boom, from 1928 to 1932, in the midst of the Great Depression, Louisiana Governor Huey Long, the progressive demagogue, the kingfish as he was called, taxed oil companies, using that money to put a chicken in every pot, give out free textbooks to school children, create evening literacy courses for adults, and build roads, bridges, hospitals, and schools. Long curbed homelessness and poverty. Before succumbing to the lure of oil money himself, Long embraced the ideal of an activist government that lifted the poor and added to the common good. By contrast, from 2007 to 2015, as mentioned, Governor Bobby Jindal drew $1.6 billion from schools and hospitals to give to companies as incentives. This strategy put some chickens in some pots, of course, and indirectly took them away from others. Like nearly everyone I talked to, Mayor Hardy twice voted for Governor Jindal, as did his family. And were he alive today, very few Louisianans would vote for Huey Long. When I ask Hardy about his political orientation, he was a moderate Republican, he immediately answers, "I've had enough of poor me." As he explains, "I don't like the government paying unwed mothers to have a lot of kids, and I don't go for affirmative action. I met this one black guy who complained he couldn't get a job. Come to find out, he'd been to private school. I went to a local public school like everyone else I know. No one should be getting a job to fill some mandated racial quota or getting state money not to work." Jindal had reduced state money for poor me's. With the jobs coming in now, we ought to close the unemployment office, Hardy declares. You can get a $15 to $18 an hour job flagging. That is, holding traffic flags around construction sites. The second of five children, Hardy had learned to stand his ground among friendly competitors for parental attention, and it was rare that he pleaded, "poor me."
He had become a beloved and effective defender of his community. But it was industry itself, he felt, that had permitted him to access his own potential and to become the man he was.
In grade school and high school, he tells me solemnly, I wasn't anything. I couldn't comprehend things.
Might he have had an undiagnosed learning disability? I ask.
No, he replies simply. I just couldn't comprehend, and I wasn't an athlete either. There was nothing I was good at.
But he continues,
when I got to the plant, starting in the maintenance department, I discovered I could do things. They promoted me from there. When I retired, I was an instrumentation foreman overseeing a lot of operators and had a salary of $180,000.
Phillips, 66, had done for Hardy what college or the army did for others. Helped him discover his native intelligence, feel honored, provide handsomely for his family without leaving his ancestral home, achieve the American dream. Why couldn't blacks and legal immigrants do the same, he thought. As a young man in the 1970s, seeking work in the plants, Hardy had been told,
we had to fill our quotas for blacks.
Was this truly the case, I wondered, or was this what company recruiters told white job seekers they turned down?
He was not a racist, Hardy told me, but he favored no special breaks for blacks or foreigners.
In a racially separated world, it's possible to have racial disadvantage without racial prejudice. Whites can turn for help to white neighbors with good connections in the plant. Blacks turn to black neighbors without them.
Maybe, Hardy thought, but that seemed a problem you could fix without the federal government horning in. Hardy had worked his own way up despite federal intervention, as he saw it.
Others I talked to felt the same, only more strongly.
Government-sponsored redistribution? No. Hardy's family members had all prospered. But in other families, some struck it rich, others got drunk and divorced and ended up poor. The family was a chancy redistribution system all its own, it seemed. After the 2008 crash, too, some got rich, others got poor. And you didn't want the government playing favorites on top of that.
It felt better to stick to the free market, to industry, to a company like Phillips 66 or Sasol. And Governor Jindal's $1.6 billion incentive to lure industry to the state?
Good idea, Hardy says.
Sure, these were the richest companies in the world, and Louisiana was a poor state.
But you needed to sweeten the deal to get companies to come to Louisiana instead of Texas, he explains. Now my grandson will have a good job here.
Maybe from a national point of view, it didn't matter if Sasol located in Houston or Lake Charles, but for Bob Hardy and his son and his grandson, it mattered greatly. As for pollution, the mayor thought it was a problem from the past.
We used to vent bad stuff, he says, but the EPA restricts flares now.
As for cancer, he thinks it is mainly genetic.
My dad's worked in and lived near the plants all his life, and I have too, and so have my brothers and son, and none of us have had cancer. But the best man at my wedding worked in and lived around the plants just like we did, and he got cancer. His brother died of it. His cousin got it. It's genes.
But, he adds,
I'll tell you where they do have a problem. That's east of here, between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. There, it's the chemicals.
Do we need good schools and nice parks? How could Westlake or Lake Charles prepare to attract new workers to the area? A 347-page regional impact study, largely funded by Sasol, ask this question. Family recruitment may present a challenge, it noted neutrally, due to the general perception of South Louisiana as portrayed in the media. The town needed to improve the quality of life in order to recruit professional chemists, engineers, and physicists from elsewhere. To do this, they had to become highly desirable places to live, with state-of-the-art public schools, innovative art and music programs, magnificent parks, freshly paved sidewalks, clean lakes to swim in, and exciting museums open regular hours. Lake Charles had a beautiful historic district, but city officials had recently approved a large cell tower in the midst of it. As for public water, a 2014 early summer swim-at-your-own-risk advisory, issued by the Louisiana Office of Public Health, warned residents of such things as sewage overflow and polluted stormwater runoff in local rivers, lakes, and marshes, and advised them not to put their hands in local water if they had open wounds. The governor, as mentioned, had cut money for schools, parks, and pollution control. By 2015, under Governor Jindal, funds for the state's 28 public colleges and universities had been drastically cut. Louisiana has long stood 46th out of 50 states in per-student spending on public education. According to the Louisiana Commission on Higher Education, since 2008, the governor has eliminated $800 million from the higher education budget, leading to cuts of academic programs and the loss of 854 faculty and 4,734 other employees. Students were thrown into turmoil. Many faculty were looking to relocate. The possibility of recruiting the best minds in the nation ground to a quick halt. Only after public outcry did the governor restore some funds to public education and cut public health and environmental protection instead. As for poor public schools, the study suggested redrawing attendance zones to accommodate growth in enrollment, and added, matter-of-factly, that the state should explore options and ramifications of ending the desegregation order. Now, a privately funded report was telling the town Sasol was moving into that its public sector was down on its heels. Your first-rate integrated schools? Where are your uncracked sidewalks? Your clean lakes? To attract outside talent for the private sector, it turned out, you needed a thriving public sector, for which the two-term Tea Party-supported governor had drastically cut funds. Mayor Hardy was trying hard to get money from Sasol so he could welcome the newcomers to a more beautiful and upgraded Westlake, but Sasol turned out to be a tough bargainer. Sasol needed water for industrial purposes, and wanted Westlake to dig a new well. But it would only pay 25% of the cost, with the state of Louisiana paying the other 75%. For the repaving of heavy haul roadways, on which Sasol was virtually the only heavy hauler, the state, parish, and town, with a grant, paid 90%, Sasol 10%. While the regional impact study called for a state-of-the-art public sector in Westlake and Lake Charles, Governor Jindal had cut state funds to the bone. Mayor Hardy had to struggle with the unwelcome thought that Westlake was a poor me. Strange events. Meanwhile, missing from the speeches at the groundbreaking ceremony and from the memories of nearly everyone I spoke to, was an event that took place near these very grounds, the largest chemical leak in American history. The leak was discovered in 1994 in a 40-year-old mile-long underground pipeline connecting Condia Vista to the Conoco docks, which were a few miles from the Arinos' home on Bayou Din. The pipe carried ethylene dichloride, EDC, and was used to store it as well. EDC is known for its capacity to penetrate dense clay and much else. A slow leak had gone undetected for decades. By the time it was discovered, 18 to 46 million pounds of EDC had sunk through the southern Louisiana blackjack clay, and scientists feared it was heading for the Chico Aquifer, the sole source of drinking water for the 700,000 people of southwest Louisiana. In 1994, Condia Vista hired cleanup workers to remove as much EDC as they could, some 1.6 million pounds of it, but the cleanup crews were given inadequate protective gear. The guys were out there in their galoshes and blue jeans digging with shovels and putting in sump pumps, one man told me. No respirators. No one warned them about the effect of EDC on breathing, on cardiac arrhythmia, or on fertility. Many cleanup workers fell ill. The men had a hard time breathing, an involved lawyer recounted. But Condia Vista management told them their illnesses derived from other causes. Finally, 500 cleanup workers sued Condia Vista. Attending public hearings on this was a tiny group of environmental activists, among whom was the ever-ebullient Lee Sherman. Lee's wife, Miss Bobby, was the group's secretary-treasurer, as well as Mike Tritico and Harold and Annette Areno. Strange things began to happen. Files went missing from the lawyer's office. A new man joined the group, became its leader, and then started disrupting meetings with accusations of wrongdoing, until, confused and discouraged, the tiny group disbanded, never to meet again. It wasn't until 2008 that people learned the cause of these strange events, and even after it became known, the tarnished memory of Condia Vista had faded. The new owner of the plant, one having nothing to do with the scandal, was Sasol. As Mayor Hardy drives us back to Town Hall, I am beginning to understand more about the context of the right. As the Serrell report had suggested, companies may try to avoid challenge by moving to communities that tend to be conservative, Republican, Catholic, high school educated, and not activist. In the case of Westlake, one of those very people had become a public-spirited mayor. The plants had allowed Bob Hardy to discover his high intelligence and capacity for leadership, his dignity, in ways his schools had failed to do. The plants allowed him to gather his entire family around him and, on a generous supervisor's salary, keep them in high comfort. Wherever the top brass of Sasol and other incoming plants lived, Bob Hardy's large, loving family, his church, his neighbors, were all right there in Westlake. Hardy didn't see how the federal government had helped him. If anything, its affirmative action policies had almost gotten in his way. But industry had been hard on Hardy, too. Four generations of Hardys have lived in Westlake. And now, with Sasol expanding, he tells me, a lot of my family is forced to move. My brother has already moved. My son and his wife were finished building their dream house, and now they're moving out. His voice softens. We have a family cemetery in the middle of the Sasol expansion. It's shaped like a triangle, and the land all around it is zoned heavy industrial now. So our family cemetery will be surrounded by Sasol on all sides. But the company has promised to give us access. My grandmother is buried there, 86 when she died. And a 9-month-old baby girl we lost is there too. I want to be buried in that cemetery. 7. The state, governing the market 4,000 feet below. The community of some 350 residents had long gloried in what they called a piece of heaven. The neat, modest homes faced Crawfish Stew Street on one side and a canal on the other, leading to the bayou and extraordinary vistas of wide-winged waterbirds swooping gracefully from water to Tupelo and Cypress. Nearly everyone had a boat, knew the good fishing spots, got on with their neighbors, and enjoyed a good crawfish boil. Mike Schaff had said of his Bayou Corn neighbors, "We're nearly all Cajun, Catholic, and conservative, predisposed to the Tea Party." but among them, Mike Schaff was the most ardent. He had joined the Tea Party, gone to meetings, spoken out. Raised in a shotgun house in the sugarcane field we had driven through together, and a lifelong employee in oil, Mike wished to feel himself in a nearly wholly private world, one as far as he could get from government taxes and regulation. But what would happen, I wondered, if a community of people such as Mike suffered a sudden catastrophe that, beyond any doubt, could have been prevented by respect for government regulation? What was his understanding about the state? Could I see why he felt as he did? These questions had led me to Mike Schaff and the Bayou Corn sinkhole. Because just that catastrophe occurred in August of 2012. First, neighbors noticed tiny clusters of bubbles on the surface of the water. Had a gas pipe traversing the bottom of the bayou sprung a leak? A man from the local gas company checked and declared the pipes fine. At the same time, Mike recalls, "We smelled oil, strong." Then he and his neighbors were startled by the shaking and rumbling of an earthquake. Since earthquakes had never before occurred in this part of Louisiana, one woman imagined a garbage truck had dropped a dumpster. A single mother of two living in a mobile home a mile from Bayou Corn thought her washing machine was on, then remembered it had been broken for months. A man was eating dinner from his TV dinner tray when it began to shake. As Mike recalls, "I was walking in the house when I felt like I was either having a stroke or drunk. 10 seconds, my balance went all to hell." A while later, he noticed a jagged crack zigzag across the concrete underneath his living room carpet. Lawns began to sag and tilt in strange directions. Not far from Mike's home, the earth under the bayou was beginning to tear open. As if a plug was pulled in a bathtub, a hollow mouth of a crack in the bottom of the bayou began sucking down brush and pine from the surface of the earth. Majestic, century-old cypress trees crashed down in slow motion and were dragged sideways into the bubbling water, drawn down into the gaping mouth of a sinkhole. Down went bush, grassland, and even a boat. An oily sheen had appeared on the surface of the water, and to prevent its spread, two cleanup workers were called in to cast booms around the oil not far from the sinkhole. To do this, the two men tied their boat to a tree, standing in it to do their work. But the tree began to tilt and drift. The workers were rescued in time, but their boat disappeared into the sinkhole. In the following days and weeks, polluted mud was thrown back up onto the surface of the water in a weird and terrible exchange of pristine swamp forest for oily sludge. Oil oozed to the surface of the water, and natural gas emanated here and there from land and water. During a rain, the puddles would shine and bubble, like you'd dropped Alka-Seltzer tablets in them, Mike says. The sinkhole grew. First it took the area of a house lot, then a football field. By 2015, the sinkhole stretched over 37 acres. Then the gassy sludge had also infiltrated the aquifer, threatening the drinking water. Residents noticed that the main road into the community began to sink, and feared it would cave in. Levees along the bayou, originally built to contain rising waters in times of flood, had also begun to sink, threatening to extend the sludge beyond their boundaries. The cause and the blame. The culprit in this strange accident was a Houston-based drilling company, Texas Brine. As its name suggests, Texas Brine drilled for intensely concentrated salt, which it sold to manufacturers of chlorine, and which is also useful in fracking. It drilled down 5,600 feet beneath the bayou into an enormous underground geological formation called a salt dome, unseen and fairly common in the Gulf. In a highly risky maneuver, disregarding the advice of their own consulting engineer, and with the okay of a government official also aware of the danger, Texas brine drilled underneath bayou corn. On the books were regulations that were disregarded by both company and state. The drill accidentally pierced a sidewall of a teardrop-shaped cavern inside the Napoleonville Dome. The Napoleonville Dome is an underground block of salt, 3 miles wide and a mile deep, sheathed by a layer of oil and natural gas. It is well known to people in the area, but not much outside it, and private companies drill deep inside the salt to hollow out pockets, large and small, some shaped like straight posts, others like mushrooms or cones. Inside them, companies store chemicals. When the drill pierced the side of one cavern inside the dome, a catastrophe slowly unfolded. Weakened, one wall of the cavern crumpled under the pressure of the surrounding shale. Water was sucked down, drawing trees and brush with it. Oil from around the dome oozed up. The earth shook. In places, its surface tilted and sank. The disaster drew public attention to a vast underground world, previously unknown to me, and raised important questions about how a free market economy, in a highly regulation-averse culture, was handling toxic chemicals in some 126 salt domes in Louisiana, plus more offshore, stored from 3,000 to 18,000 feet beneath the surface of the earth. In the Napoleonville Salt Dome, a lively commerce was going on. Petrochemical companies own 53 caverns, and some 7 more companies rent space in them. These are valuable large storage depots for the many chemicals used in oil drilling, fracking, and plastic manufacturing. Texas Brine rents 6 caverns. Dow and Union Carbide owns others into which they have pumped 50 million gallons of ethylene dichloride, EDC. While it surprised me to learn how far down into the earth free enterprise went, such underground storage systems have long been accepted practice in the Gulf region. The National Petroleum Reserves have themselves long been stored in a similar way. Still, I wondered, if one company could drill one hole in one cavern and cause a sinkhole that made methane gas bubble in rain puddles, what else could happen with earthquakes now in motion and other EDC-filled caverns nearby? All in a culture in which the very idea of regulation has fallen into very low esteem. My keyhole issue had taken me 4,000 feet down into the earth. And following it down the hole was the great paradox. The Tea Party feared, disdained, and wanted to diminish the federal government. But they also wanted a clean and safe environment, one without earthquakes sending toxins into aquifers or worse. But here was the rub. Didn't America need a culture of respect for the safeguarding of such concerns? Don't we need government workers, ones with no skin in the game, to do the safeguarding? How did my good, bright, and caring friend Mike Schaff and others put these two desires together? The Minimal State. Dapper in a blue shirt and khaki pants, Governor Bobby Jindal steps down from his helicopter and strides rapidly toward a cluster of waiting officials and restless refugees from the Bayou Corn Sinkhole, as it is now named. Many residents, 7 months on, are still homeless, doubling up with relatives, living in trailers, motels, and campers. One couple had celebrated Thanksgiving in a 24-hour laundromat because they had nowhere else to go.
Burly security men with close-shorn hair and dark glasses fan out around the governor. Hand outstretched, Jindal walks rapidly forward to greet officials and listens, head tilted, hands on hips, to their words. He moves toward a podium set in a green field not far from the sinkhole. The earth had opened ominously on August 3, 2012. 4 months later, on December 16, 2012, a resident posted on his Facebook page, "Where are you, Bobby Jindal? You were elected to be the leader of our state. Bayou Corn, Grand Bayou, was declared a state of emergency by your office on August 3, 2012. There are mini earthquakes, methane, benzene, and hydrogen sulfide being released into the community. This community has been through hell and back and is still living a nightmare. In my opinion and many others, you have done absolutely nothing helpful to this community." 7 months after the disaster, on March 19, 2013, Governor Jindal visits the sinkhole for the very first time. He has helicoptered in from Baton Rouge, 40 miles away. "It's only a 5-minute ride," one disgruntled resident tells me, to address the gathering. With a line of white-shirted officials behind him and a thin scattering of distressed residents, arms folded, facing him, Governor Jindal speaks rapidly and emphatically from a fact-studded script. The very pace of his talk conveys mastery, urgency, busyness, and perhaps avoidance. "The state is doing all it can to help," he tells the gathering. "He's appointing an independent blue-ribbon commission. He's on the case." The governor finishes his prepared remarks and calls on local officials to speak, before finally opening himself to restless residents for questions. One resident asks the governor why he waited 7 months to come the short distance, noting that the governor announced his visit only at 9 a.m. of the morning he was to arrive at 2 p.m. the same afternoon. Another asks why, after the 7-month delay, such short notice. Why was the meeting also set for 2 o'clock on a weekday when most people would be at work? Had the governor seen the sinkhole? By now, the homes of 350 residents were part of a sacrifice zone, as officials called it. A geologist hired by Texas Brine had earlier explained to shocked residents that "nobody in the world has ever faced a situation like this." Was a nearby cavern, still being drilled into, also in danger of collapse? When would the gas, the earthquakes, stop? "The Blue Ribbon Commission is looking into it," the governor says. A two-beer levee job. To drive to Mike Schaff's home, I turn right on Gumbo Street, left on Jambalaya, pass Sauce Piquant Lane, and park on Crawfish Street, opposite a two-story yellow wooden home. The street is deserted, the grass high. Planted around his yard are fruit trees, Satsuma orange, grapefruit, mango, and fig, but the fruit hangs unpicked.
"I'm sorry about the grass," Mike says as he greets me wearing an orange and red striped t-shirt, jeans, and boots. With the sweep of a muscular arm, he points to an unpruned rose arbor. "Just haven't kept the place up." Mike has set out coffee, cream, sugar, and a jar of peaches to take when I leave. "This has been the longest 6 months of my life. To tell you the truth, I'm depressed," he says. "5 years ago, I moved here from Baton Rouge to live with my new wife," he says, pouring us coffee. "But with the methane gas emissions all around us now, it's not safe. So my wife has moved back to Alexandria and commutes to her job from there. I see her on weekends. The grandkids don't come either, because what if someone lit a match? The house could blow up."
Mike sleeps uneasily. He has placed a gas monitor in his garage and checks it from time to time.
The company drilled a hole in my garage to see if there was gas under it. There was. 20% higher than normal.
He avoids lighting matches. He lives day to day among his cardboard boxes, keeping watch over his neighbor's property and a wary eye on wandering feral cats. The governor had issued an evacuation order for all residents of Bayou Corn, but Mike could not bring himself to leave.
I'm here to guard the place against a break-in. There have been quite a few, and to keep the other stayers company.
After a long pause, he adds,
Actually, I don't want to leave. Excuse this, he says,
pointing to a jagged crack in the cement to the side of a rolled-up carpet.
The earthquake caused that. We never had earthquakes before the sinkhole. Or methane gas rising from our lawns.
After coffee, Mike walks me to the edge of his backyard, speaking in the present tense, as if his life is ongoing.
This is where we have neighbors in for crawfish boils.
Visible across the canal and up and down it are other patios with grills, yoo-hooing distance across. But now he tells me,
It's no longer Janet and Jerry. It's no longer Tommy. It's no longer Nicky and his wife. It's no longer Mr. Jim.
He points around.
It's Texas Brine, Texas Brine, Texas Brine, and Texas Brine. It'll be 88 weeks this Monday, he continues. As of now, there's me, Tommy, Victor, and Brenda. And that's it.
Texas Brine has been negotiating prices to buy neighbors out. It had been a close-knit community with a shared devotion to fishing, hunting, wildlife, and conservative politics. Married 5 years to his beautiful new wife, Mike's third marriage, his wife's second, this is the last situation he'd imagined being in.
We're a close community here.
He gestures around as if to introduce me to invisible friends.
We have our own Mardi Gras, parties at Miss Eddie's birdhouse.
The husband of a neighbor, a bird lover, had built a structure to shelter birds, considered noisy by neighbors. After he died, his widow converted it into a party house with a jacuzzi and strobe lights.
We help each other rebuild levees during floods. You got the 2-beer levee job or the 4-beer one?
He laughs. We love it here. Other Bayou Corn refugees I would interview said the same. One man named Nick showed more photos of children parading around the neighborhood in decorated bikes, neighbors in decorated golf carts, and boat trailers for the Mardi Gras Bayou Corn Hookers Parade. Celebrants dancing in the street. Some years to the music of a live band.
We used to have fishing tournaments. The winner was the one with the heaviest catch, and we ended up holding a fish fry.
Even if government helped people, and he didn't think it did much, government should never, Mike felt, erode the spirit of a community. He had grown up in a dense circle of aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandparents, all within walking distance from each other on the Armalese plantation. Now in his 60s, Mike felt happy to live in a community as close and cooperative as the one he had known as a boy. For a man who could lose himself for hours in the garage assembling a 2-seater Zenith 701 airplane from a kit, and who described himself as to myself, such a community brought cheer. The sociability of Bayou Corn brought him out of himself. It wasn't the simple absence of government Mike wanted. It was the feeling of being inside a warm, cooperative group. He thought the government replaced that. His was also a love of place. Just as Mayor Hardy loved Westlake, Mike Schaff loved Bayou Corn. Just as Sasol was expanding onto Hardy family land, so Texas Brine had taken over Mike's home. But there was a difference.
Hardy's family had been handsomely paid, his own home was unharmed, and he didn't mind industry as a neighbor. But Mike's home was invisible ruin, and the community he loved was scattered to the wind, to Mississippi, Texas, and other parts of Louisiana. Mike disappears into his boat garage and backs his boat out into the canal. I climb in. The boat sputters to life and puts out of the canal into the wider bayou. Swerving around dark stumps of dead cypress trees, we duck under strips of low-hanging Spanish moss, which look like fuzzy tatters of an old fur coat, hanging from cypress, tupelo gum trees, and swamp maples. We duck again to putt under a low bridge, then speed into a widening vista.
Around here you pull up bass, catfish, white perch, crawfish, and sacalay. At least, we used to. Now, they're swimming in a methane bath.
At a distance, we see a red, white, black, and yellow sign nailed to the gray trunk of a tupelo. Danger! Keep out! Highly flammable gas! The reflection of the warning wobbles in the rippling water. Mike points to small, concentric circles of bubbles scuttling outward like small bugs.
Methane.
Rumor, panic, blame. After the sinkhole, talk turned to blame, which ricocheted wildly from one thing to another. First, Texas Brine blamed Mother Nature. Earthquakes were natural in this area, officials said, which wasn't true. Then it blamed and sued Occidental Chemical Company, the company from which it rented space in the Napoleonville Salt Dome. Then Texas Brine's insurance company blamed Texas Brine and refused to pay insurance. Then Texas Brine sued the insurance company. The legal wrangling expanded. Only 1,600 feet from the cave-in, Crosstech Energy Services rented an adjacent underground vault in the dome, filled with the equivalent of 940,000 barrels of butane gas. Wishing to continue business as usual, Crosstech sued Texas Brine on grounds that the cave-in had prevented them from expanding and led to the loss of storage contracts it could have made with companies wanting to rent. In 2015, Texas Brine sued yet another company, Oxy Petroleum, for $100 million for weakening the cavern wall by drilling too close to the cavern's edge back in 1986, and so causing the disaster in 2012. And so it went. Meanwhile, still doubled up with family in spare rooms, trailers, and motels, shell-shocked refugees commuted to work from temporary quarters, turning to each other by email and to the internet and television news for updates. Anxious rumors flew. Would the stored gas ignite, causing a firestorm? Would earthquakes break the walls of other caverns containing dangerous chemicals? One alarmed writer for the Denver-based website Examiner.com feared an explosion with the force of more than 100 H-bombs like the ones in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Others called for calm and reason. Apparently wanting a break from the anxious talk, one man who'd stayed in his Bayou Corn home wrote on Facebook, "Took a break from painting patio furniture and caught 8 of these little beauties. Photo of fish, right from my pier in about an hour." Some contributors to a website called The Sinkhole Bugle blamed both the company and the government, but aimed their deepest anger at the government. Dennis Landry, owner of Cajun Cabins of Bayou Corn, pointed out, correctly, that the State Department of Natural Resources knew for months that the Texas Brine well had integrity problems and didn't tell local authorities. "I'm very upset about it. I feel like I've been betrayed by the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources." One man even described Texas Brine as
the fall guy. Moral dirty work. It was becoming easier to understand why energy refugees were so furious at the state government.
First of all, it turned out that the secretary of the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources from 2004 to 2014, Scott Angel, had known of the weak cavern wall, but had given Texas brine a permit to drill anyway. He had been transferred soon after the event to a different job, and was now, to Mike's horror, running for governor. Angel later lost.
Indeed, the caverns had been casually regulated. Similar accidents had occurred in the past and been forgotten, or remembered but discounted, like the structural amnesia the Arinos had encountered. Energy companies had understated the value of these caverns and their contents, and had been undertaxed, it was discovered. The problem was not that the state government was too big, too intrusive, too controlling. It seemed to me that the state government had barely been present at all. Beyond this, there were different expectations of business and government. Companies made money and were beholden to stockholders. It was understandable if they tried to cover their ass, people told me. But the government was paid to protect people, so one could expect much more of them. Still, victims felt surprisingly hurt by Texas brine, belying hope of a more personal touch.
After the sinkhole, company officials didn't come around to ask how we were doing, and after they reimbursed us, they gave us a month to get out, one aggrieved refugee told me.
When an ill 83-year-old man asked Texas brine for more time to get out, they said, okay, an extra week. Texas brine didn't care. They were all about money. Mike himself expressed mixed feelings toward Texas brine. He offered a bag of Satsuma mandarins to the Texas brine manager at the beginning of one community meeting, quipping,
these don't have razors in them.
Later he told me,
I laughed, but the manager didn't.
Victims were mad that Texas brine didn't have a heart, but not contemptuous. On the other hand, state officials were seen as tepid followers of corrupt higher-ups, whose envied new SUVs were seen as paid for by my taxes. Overall, just how well did Louisiana state officials do in protecting its citizens? An eye-opening 2003 report from the Inspector General of the EPA offered an answer. Charged with evaluating implementation of federal policies by each state within the nation's six regions, the report ranked Louisiana lowest of all in Region 6. Companies had not been required to submit reports. Louisiana's database on hazardous waste facilities was filled with errors. The Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, a title missing the word protection, did not know if many companies were or were not in compliance. Delays allowed 16 facilities to discharge material into Louisiana waters without permits. The agency had failed to inspect many plants. Even when it found companies out of compliance, it had neglected to levy penalties, or if they were levied, to collect them. The inspector general concluded that he was unable to fully assure the public that Louisiana was operating programs in a way that effectively protects human health and the environment. Why such low marks? Three reasons, the inspector general concluded. Natural disasters, low funds, and a culture in which the state agency is expected to protect industry. As for lack of resources, funding for environmental protection had been cut in 2012 from a previous 3.5% of total yearly state funds to 2.2%. An alert auditor had also discovered that the state had accidentally given back about $13 million to oil and gas companies that it should have retained in taxes. As for the pro-industry culture, permitting was indeed relatively easy. According to the state's own website, 89,787 permits to deposit waste or do anything that affected the environment were submitted between 1967 and July 2015. Of these, only 60, or 0.07%, were denied. Some state reports also reflected